And I came across this thing called Undesigned Coincidences. And I thought, what is this? I've never heard of this before. And I think it's kind of a weird title because it almost suggests as if the Bible is not really designed. It's just kind of happenstance. That's not what it's going to mean. But I'm just giving you the title that if you were to do a Google search, this is what you're going to come up with. It'll tell you the stuff we're talking about tonight. So Sharon and I were talking on the way in here. There must be a better title for that thing. But, you know, who am I to make a change? So that's what you're going to find if you look it up, Undesigned Coincidences. And I titled it A New Old Apologetics. It's been around since the 1800s. But it just has kind of disappeared. Two or three people wrote books on it, and it was a big thing back in the 1800s, and then it just sort of sat there, and nobody paid attention to it over the last 100, 150 years. And then one man, Tim McGrew is his name, has kind of rediscovered it, and he's making a big deal about it, and he's been interviewed, and he was the one I heard on the Apologetics 315 blog that I was listening to. So I just thought it was a terrific thing. I wanted to share it with you tonight. But here's what I want you to do to start, though. You got a blank side of the page that I gave you. Would you just jot down, if you don't have a pen or pencil, you can just kind of think this out. You don't need to write it down. Oh, good. Okay. Great. Would you write down just three or four things that you remember from last week's class here? And I'm not even going to tell you what things, just whatever you remember about the class. If you weren't here, maybe just think good thoughts for a couple of minutes. Esther already told me she wasn't here, so that kind of keeps her out of the loop here for a second. But this is not a test, right? You can keep it. I'm not collecting it or anything. But just two or three things. It's just for you to remember so you can just write a note. You don't have to write full sentences or anything like that.
Was there a class last
week? Oh, yeah.
There was a class last week.
Okay.
It's all about Prabhupada.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. It's the talk with the big light on the screen. The light bulb.
Without
letting your light shine.
Oh,
Vasan's
talk.
I was like, did I miss it?
Yeah.
Vasan's talk.
Vasan's talk. I don't feel asleep again.
What happened, Adam?
Just three or four. Just, you know, something really short.
Can you repeat what we're
doing? Yeah, just three or four things that you remember from last week's class. Mm-hmm. And I'm keeping it very vague on purpose. I'm not asking you for particular things because that's part of what I'm trying to get across here tonight. That's probably long enough. We're not going to stretch this out too long. But what things did you remember? Anybody remember how many people were here, for example? Anybody put that down? Okay, we got no mathematicians that are... Okay, so nobody was counting.
But I wasn't here.
Yeah, that's right. did you remember who spoke? Did anybody write that down? Okay, so because I heard somebody say Assad.
Yeah.
Spoke, okay.
I did
a
point for that.
Yeah.
You spoke too.
And what?
Me and Assad.
Oh, okay. So there were announcements as well. What was this? Did anybody know what his message was on?
Is that shining?
Light shining. Okay. Anybody remember? Was there a particular passage that he took you to?
It's 2:12.
Philippians. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Any particular like prayer requests or anything unusual happened last Sunday?
Told a story about the blackout.
Told a story about what?
The blackout.
Oh, he's told a story about the... Okay, that's appropriate, huh?
Pastor Kirk coming over to his house with his son, and they had a big sleepover because the lights were gone.
Oh, that's cool. That's neat.
And they had a light in the front yard, and it attracted all the neighbors who had no light. They had a torch.
That's nice. Now, you may say, what in the world has this got to do with apologetics at this point? But would you agree, if you looked at your sheet, it might not agree with other people's necessarily? Like you may have thought about a person that you talked to last week, but other people didn't. Some of you mentioned the story of Kirk and Assad getting together, but maybe some of you didn't mention that. Some of you may have thought about, gee, it started a little late. Maybe somebody else didn't think about that. I could have asked you what songs were sung, and you may or may not have remembered those. You might have gotten two, but really there were three. So did you notice that you are all eyewitnesses, right? Most of you were eyewitnesses last week. But you have slightly different stories, not that one was a lie, but that you just, if we put them all together, we would get the complete story, right? Does that make sense? And that's not what happens when you have a forgery, right? If you have a forgery, let's think about that for a second. You're trying to forge a picture, you're trying to forge a document. Thinking about the Bible, one of the big complaints that you hear is that, oh, these gospel stories were all invented hundreds of years, you know, after the time. These were not eyewitnesses. There was not really Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. These are people that just took those names and knew that they were a big deal in the early church. And so 200 years later, 300 years later, legends are starting to creep in. And they decide they'll tell some stories about Jesus. And they all get together and they hash out these stories. I mean, that's kind of the conspiracy theory that's out there among some people today. Now, if you're going to forge something, are you going to have the kinds of stories that I just heard now? Or is it going to be different? What's going to happen with a forgery? Is it going to leave any loose ends? No, a forger, by definition, is going to want to make it as complete as possible. They don't want to have anybody scratching their head going, well, I don't get this, or this doesn't seem complete, or this seems like it's got a particular view, but I'd like to have heard it from, you know, another perspective. They won't do that, right? Forgers are very careful. If you're trying to forge a signature, they're going to get every loop, even though, you know, you write differently sometimes. You're in a hurry. You're at a checkout, and I don't know about your signature. Mine turns into just nothing when I'm at whatever, Home Depot or something. But so the forger, though, is going to be very, very careful, right? And they're going to do that with documents as well. And yet, an eyewitness, by definition, is probably going to see things a little differently maybe than another eyewitness. That's why cops are going to go around at an accident and try to interview more than one person, right? Because they're not expecting lies, but they're expecting different people will see things slightly differently, and then if you get enough of them, you got the whole picture. And so that's what we're going to talk about tonight, this thing called undesigned coincidences. But just as a warm-up to that, I gave you a list under number two about Gospels as eyewitness accounts. We have some Gospels are called synoptic. Do you know which ones there are? We have four Gospels. Which are the ones that are called synoptic?
First three,
right? Matthew, Mark, Luke. Syn means with, and optic is to see with. So in other words, they tend to be more alike. Sometimes look at a parallel Bible where they have all four, and you'll see that John doesn't have any parables. Isn't that weird? But he's got miracles that the others don't have. And it's a very different look because they were eyewitnesses, right? If they're going to make this stuff up, they're going to try to say the same thing so it's a unified picture. But you don't get a unified picture. You get these different people looking at things. One of the Gospels, I was going to see what your best guess is here. One of the Gospels apparently used Peter because there are, well, we don't have the time to do that, but there are some places you can go to that sounds like only things Peter would have heard.
Mark
seems to have used Peter. In fact, Peter later on talks about his dear son, Mark. And so they apparently had a really close relationship. Now, one of the Gospels apparently used a lot from Mary because we hear her song. We find out what she was thinking of when the Holy Spirit showed up. And anybody know which one that is?
Luke.
That's probably Luke, right? We get all these songs, and it's really beautiful at the beginning, all these wonderful songs. But we get Mary, and she does something called the Magnificat, and then Bach got a hold of that one and made a great musical out of it. Now, one has a lot of references to the Old Testament, more so than the others.
Matthew
has a ton of them, right? Matthew is kind of the rabbinical look at Jesus. In fact, if you look at his genealogy, it's a different genealogy than Luke, and people talk about that all the time, but he wanted to take Jesus back to Abraham, right? Because he's part of the Jewish culture, whereas do you know how far back Luke takes the genealogy?
Adam,
right? Because Jesus is the Savior of the world. He's a Jew, but he's for the world. So we get these differences. So I wanted to take you to some places that I just found really fascinating. Like I said, just came across this a couple months back, and I bet you've read the Gospels like I have several times, and you may not have noticed these things that you'll catch on in just a second. I almost have to give you examples and to try to explain it, but you'll get, for example, Matthew will tell a story, but there's going to be some elements missing, and you go, well, now that I think about it, I'm not sure what's going on here. And then one of the other Gospels will tell you the rest of the story. And you wouldn't get that if they were all hatching this thing out together. But because each one has a slightly different perspective, you put them together and you go, ah, and then you get the whole picture. So I know at this point it's kind of weird, but let me take you to some examples here. Matthew 26, let's start there. So I'm on 3A there, Matthew 26. Right near the end, 67 and 68. Let me get my glasses here.
26?
Yeah, Matthew 26. Okay, this is Jesus. Now he's been captured and he's being pummeled and you know, just awful things that you probably saw in the movie The Passion of the Christ. 67 says, "They spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, 'Prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you?'" Well, let's stop there for a second. I know you've read this. I know you have the picture of this in your head. But if you just think about those words, what seems odd about this? They go up to Jesus and they hit him. They say, "Try to figure out who hit us or who hit you." I mean, wouldn't that be obvious that if Jesus is standing there, somebody punches him and says, "Who hit you?" He's going to say, "You did. You're the one right there." I mean, it seems like an odd question to ask. But if you turn over to Luke 22, we see why they would ask that question, but it's not in Matthew. You probably know where I'm going with this already, don't you? Luke 22, again, near the end of the chapter, 63. "The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him." Here's the new piece of information. What'd they do? They blindfolded him. Now, Matthew doesn't have that. So just by itself, Matthew is telling the story. I mean, it's the same story, isn't it? But just Matthew just went past that and just told the part about how cruel they were to Jesus, whereas Luke, from a slightly different angle, says they put a blindfold on him and then they played this idiotic game. You know, "You're such a prophet, tell us who hit you." So that makes more sense, but you put the two together and you go, oh, okay. Let's try one more, now that you got kind of the hang of it here. Mark 6, 31. Again, it's just one of those little things, and it wouldn't make you, you know, go to a Bible commentary or something, but it's just kind of interesting. Verse 31 says, "Because so many people were coming and going, they didn't have a chance to eat, he said, 'Let's go to someplace quiet.'" And that's all they say. It says just a lot of people. And you may say, okay, there are a lot of people. But there's no reason given for why are there so many people. Is it just because Jesus is popular? Well, the reason is actually given if you go over to John 6. I think Assad put a note out and asked you to bring your Bibles, right? Because we're doing a lot of hopping tonight. John 6, 4. What do you learn? What do you learn there? It says, "Jesus went up on a mountainside, sat down with his disciples," and what's going on? Yeah, it's Passover. So what does that mean? It says the Jewish Passover. That's a big deal, right? This is a national holiday, but I don't want to say holiday thinking like, you know, good stuff. I mean, Passover is a very serious thing, but this was something where you had a lot of Jews involved in this, right? It would be just a flurry of activity. So that's why Jesus is saying in the other one, let's get away someplace a little quieter. So it wasn't just that people are following him. It was this Passover that was going on. Let's try Matthew 8:16. Luckily, we're just going back and forth through four Gospels, so we don't have to go too far. Matthew 8:16. This is, lost it here. Oh, here we go. Jesus, my title at 14 says, "Jesus heals many." And then if you pick up on verse 16, "When evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with the word and healed all the sick." And I don't know about you, but if I'm really sick or I've got something demonic going on, I think I want to get helped earlier in the day, don't you? And if you're there to help somebody, wouldn't you want to be there early in the day and say, boy, as soon as Jesus is out and moving, I want to take my sick friend. But this says it occurred in the evening. Okay. But we don't know why all of a sudden the evening people are able to go to Jesus and get healed. You'll find out if you flip over to the beginning of Mark, first chapter. Mark 1, And what's the verse I have here? 121. Look at 121. They went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, Jesus went in the synagogue and began to teach. And then later on 29, it says as soon as they left the synagogue, and then 32 says that evening. So it's all one day, right? So it says that evening, says after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all of those who were sick and needing some kind of healing. So why'd they wait?
It's the Sabbath.
It's a Sabbath. And what's the deal about the Sabbath?
No.
You're not supposed to work on Sunday. So Jesus knows this is going to cause way more problems. And the other people know that too, that you just wait till the sun goes down, then you're allowed to do, you know, whatever it is that you want to do, your work. So notice again how the one just told us evening came. It didn't tell you what day of the week it was. This one puts the two together. You go, oh, okay, what evening was it? It was the evening of the Sabbath. So now it's okay. You can bring those people out. So they were getting them to Jesus as soon as they could. Can you imagine if somebody's just deathly ill and you're standing there waiting, you're just watching that sun go down and say, please, you know, I want this person to stay with us till we can get them over to Jesus. Yeah?
That's because the Jewish day is from night to morning, not like morning from night like we have.
Yeah, good point. So at this stage, then they're allowed to bring out the sick that can go to Jesus. Let's try Luke 9. I don't know about you, but now I think it's going to cause me to read the Gospels a little differently because it's interesting how these all tie into one story. Luke 9:36. This is Jesus up on the mount, and he has Moses and Elijah show up with him. Can you imagine you're a disciple and you're just kind of hanging out there with Jesus? Hey, I wonder what we're going to do today. He says, come with me, guys. And I always wondered, they have name tags? I don't know. Somebody would have to tell them, right? That's Moses, that's Elijah. Oh, okay. I don't know that they would have looked like, you know, I mean, what would you expect? I don't know. Somebody had to tell them, but they knew. Wow, what a scene, huh? Transfiguration, this person that you've been sleeping with and eating with and just hanging out with, maybe punching them in the ribs, you know, hey, that's a good joke. And then all of a sudden you see, wow, something's revealed here. What a moment when the two most famous figures of the Old Testament show up with him to verify this is something awfully special going on. And yet, if you look at 9:36, Luke 9:36, when the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone. The disciples kept this to themselves and told no one what they had seen. Well, would you feel like telling people? I would.
Who's going to believe?
Well, that could be, right? And you may say, yeah, and what have you been smoking? Right? But it says they told nobody. And so you say, well, you know, why would that be? Because, I mean, you saw the most dramatic thing in the history of the world. As far as you're concerned, you saw a revelation from a spiritual side of life that you'd never seen before. The veil has been pulled back. You got this brief glimpse of the divinity as well as the humanity of Jesus. Well, go over to Mark 9:9. Luke won't tell us. He's got his angle and doing whatever he wants to do. But if we go to Mark 9:9, it's the same story. It's the transfiguration. Verse 9, as they were coming down the mountain, here's the part that Luke doesn't say, Jesus did what? Gave them orders or commanded them not to tell anyone what they had seen. So it wasn't that they just decided as a group, hey, nobody's going to believe us. Jesus actually said, don't say anything. Okay. Well, if Jesus tells you to do something, you snap too, especially after what you just saw. It's like, wow, okay, so we should keep this to ourselves. I think my favorite one out of all of these is the next one. It's John. It starts with, and notice this is three different places we have to look. Okay, let's start with John 6:5. You'll recognize the story here. John 6:5. This is Jesus feeding the 5,000. You know that story. So here are all these people that show up, and he goes up on the mountainside, and when Jesus, verse 5, when Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip. Now, Philip's not a big name apostle, would you agree? Disciple? I mean, he's not, who would you put in the top tier?
John.
Peter.
John, Peter.
John.
James.
Maybe James.
Yeah.
Andrew, maybe. Right, but do you think of Philip right off? He's kind of an unknown entity. What's that?
Nobody.
but here he is. Jesus turns to Philip. Now think about this. So we're going to find out why in just a second. He turns to Philip out of all the disciples. Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat? It says he was doing it to test them. But it's Philip. So you say, okay, so he picks Philip. Just probably felt like Philip hadn't had much attention, you know, so now he's going to... That's not it. There's more to it. It's going to take us two more steps, though. So let's go to John 1:44. It's still the book of John. But John puts something else very early in the story here, John 1:44. It says, Philip, like two others, Andrew and Peter, are from a town of Bethsaida. Okay, do you see that? Bethsaida. So far we have two parts of the clue, right? We know who Jesus talked to, and now we find out, oh, that's right, he's the guy from Bethsaida. But there's got to be one more step, because it still doesn't make sense unless we go, and John doesn't tell us, unless we go to Luke 9. Verse 10. When the apostles returned, this is minds headed again, Jesus feeds the 5,000. They reported to Jesus what they did, and then he says he took them with him, and they withdrew by themselves to a town where? Bethsaida. So why does he turn to Philip and say, Philip, where can we get some food?
That's where he's from.
He's a local guy. It's like, you know the food around here. Right? Is there a Pizza Hut? Something good? But so, yeah, you'd turn to Philip, right? That's why out of the 12, Jesus asked him. Now, it says, of course, he was doing it to test him as well. But notice how you have to take three pieces of advice or pieces of information. Two are from John, but they're not the same part. You know, one's early just to tell you this guy's from Bethsaida. And then Jesus turns to him. Then we have to go someplace else to find out why Philip in particular, because he was from that area. So I thought that was an interesting one. I love the fact you have to jump three different places. John 21:15 is the next one. We're in... Oh, sorry. I thought we were in John.
Yeah.
John 21. This is after Jesus' resurrection. He's with the disciples and they're out eating. And it says, when they finished eating, verse 15, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these? Who do you think that these are?
Everybody else.
Yeah, which are the disciples, right? So all the disciples are gathered. So Jesus says to Peter, he takes him aside probably, and says, do you really love me more than these? Now, Peter has never said in the book of John anything about the other disciples. He just says, I'll stand up for you, Jesus. Remember at the crucifixion? I'll be with you. Don't worry about me, Peter. And Jesus says, oh, really? Now we know how that goes. But this is a different thing, isn't it? He says, they're the other disciples, Peter. You really care for me more than the others? Well, we'll find out why if we flip over to Matthew 26. Matthew 26:33. So, this is the section titled Jesus Predicts Peter's Denial. Peter in verse 33 says, even if all fall away on account of you, I never will. So do you see, there's the point where he makes the boast. Hey, I know these guys are kind of shaky, but, you know, I'm there. Count me in, Jesus says, really. So that's the whole part of his boast, right? That he says, I can handle it. These other guys can't take that kind of pressure. So no wonder Jesus says then to him later on, you really love me more than these? Remember what you said, Peter? But we have to go to a different gospel to find out what it was Peter actually said to him. Okay, that was the Matthew thing. You guys okay on this? Can we do a couple more?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We got enough time?
Mm-hmm.
We're okay. Let's do, so that was, how about Luke 20? Did we do Luke 23? No. Mm-hmm. I kind of lose track here. Matthew, Mark, Luke 20. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Keep me honest here in case I get off. Oh, yeah, this is an interesting one. This one, I mean, I've read it probably a dozen times, and it didn't hit me until I listened to this Tim McGrew talking about it. Here's the time when Jesus is brought before the Roman authority. Now, why is that a big deal? Why did the Jews have to turn to the Romans? Why didn't they just take care of Jesus?
They weren't allowed to execute.
Yeah, they were not allowed to execute. That right had been taken away from them. If they wanted to get rid of Jesus big time and not just punish him, they had to give him to the Romans. So think about this. Here's Pilate. He has life and death over Jesus. The last thing Pilate wants to hear is that this guy is on his way to start an insurrection, right? His job is to keep the land there quiet. And apparently he was real good at that, except he got too brutal later on. The stories are told that he was recalled back to Rome because he was so brutal. And so listen to how he interviews Jesus and what he says. So verse 3. Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Because that's the story, right? The Jews have come to the Romans and said, "This guy claims he's a king. We only have one king. That's Caesar. Take him out. This guy deserves the ultimate punishment." So Pilate says, "Is this true?" Jesus says, "Yes." And then, here's the remarkable part. Let's stop there for just a second. If you're the Roman commander of all, and a guy comes before you and says, "Yeah, I'm king of the Jews," what would you do? Would you say, "This guy's in trouble," or would you let him go?
What is it to them, though, to the Romans?
Well, a guy claims to be the king.
Didn't want anyone to defy the government.
But if he's king of the Jews, the Romans set up their own puppet kings there. You know, they had the Herods and all those people. I mean, they don't want anybody else with any kind of claim unless the Romans gave it to them, right? So it just strikes me as odd as, look at his response. Instead of saying, "What? We got another king here? I don't think so. Let's get this guy out. You know, you're in trouble." And what is Pilate's remark here? Verse 4, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." Now that's the opposite, really, of what you should expect, I would think. Are you a king? Yeah. Okay. You can go.
Wait.
What? I mean, doesn't that seem, if you start thinking about it, it seems odd. Okay, so that's Luke 23. Go to John and we'll see what else Jesus said that Luke didn't report on. John 18:28. Okay, here we go. Actually, if that's okay, I think I'll pick up on 29. So he's now in front of the Roman governor. So Pilate comes out and he says, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" Now we hear more of the story. He says, "We can't execute anybody, so we have to give him to you." And verse 33, Pilate went back inside the palace and asked the same question, right? This is the question we heard from in Luke. "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus says, you know, "Where'd you come up with that idea, basically?" And Pilate says, "Am I a Jew? Is your own people? What is it you've done?" And Jesus says, "My kingdom is what? Is not of this world. I am not an earthly king." Do you think that would make Pilate feel better?
Yeah.
This guy's not a threat, right? Pilate must have been ready to launch on this guy, and he says, "Well, I'm not a king of this world," which must mean, you know, I'm a spiritual leader, spiritual king. Oh, okay. Well, then we can't go after somebody like that. It's just the threat to Rome, the threat to whoever's in power back in Rome, the threat to the Herods, whoever's in power there. But this,
that he thought he was kind of nuts,
and that could be, yeah.
So, he's harmless. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, I think the next sentence too adds some more. "If it were my followers would fight to keep me from being handed over to the Jewish leaders." So, you know, then Pilate's just thinking, well, even if he thinks he's a king, he doesn't have any power, nobody likes him, so he's no threat.
Whatever. Yeah, yeah. Jesus basically said nobody's coming to fight for him.
Right.
Yeah, so he's got no army, he's not that kind of a leader. And so you can see why in the other book, which was Luke, that Pilate would go, "Oh, I see no problem here." Right? So there's the complete story if we get the two put together. Let's do one more. This is Matthew 14. This is Herod. Boy, what a lovely family. You ever read about the Herod family? Oh, man. It makes Dallas and, I mean, it's like the ultimate soap opera, except this is vicious. These people were killing each other right and left. Anyway, so we got Herod. And so he has heard about Jesus. He's hearing these stories about Jesus. In verse 2, in chapter 14 of Matthew, he turns to his... Now, mine is the NIV, and it says attendants, but there's a better word for it. Do you have any other word that it uses besides attendants?
Advisors?
Mm-hmm. Yours says advisors?
This says advisor.
It says servants.
Yeah, see, I looked it up, and it's interesting we have a different view of these things, but I looked up in the English Standard Version, which is kind of the up-and-comer now, and that uses servants. And so I'm going to go with servants. If you say advisors, it changes this thing completely. Does this make sense? If you're a king like a Herod, you don't talk to your servants, right? They just come and do things, or you just order them. "Come here, take this, clean this, get out. Call for so-and-so." But he's asking, he's going to his servants and saying, "Hey, what's this I'm hearing? Now, that seems odd for somebody to go to a servant. They're not supposed to give you information. They just are supposed to serve you. But we find out, if we go over to Luke 8, why he might have decided that there was somebody that could help him from the servant rank. Luke 8, 3. And we find out some of the people that are following Jesus. And one of them says some women. And one of them is Joanna, the wife of Cusa. And what's Cusa's job?
He's a
head business guy for Herod. So Herod must know that there are some people that have been talking around there, and they've talked up Jesus somehow among the servant ranks. And now he's going, well, my advisors don't hang out with him, but some of my servants do, and some of the, you know, somebody knows somebody who knows somebody. And so he talks to them and says, hey, what's going on with this Jesus guy? So he ignores his advisors and he goes to the servants because there's some connection with Jesus and these women that are following him. So I thought that was interesting. I'll just end on one that you don't need to turn to. I'll do it kind of in a hurry, because at this time, it's not two places in the gospel. It's one place in the gospel and one place outside the gospel. If you know the story, Jesus is taken by his parents when he's really little to get away from Herod, right? And they go where?
Egypt.
They head off to Egypt, right? Egypt is always where people go when there's a problem, right? That's in the Old Testament. Let's go to there's a famine. Let's go to Egypt. So anyway, they go to Egypt and kind of hang out there for a while, and then they get the word that Herod has died. And then they find out that Herod Archelaus is the, I think he's one of Herod's sons. Now he's taken over. Is he the son? So he's taken over, and it says, Joseph was afraid and went up to Nazareth. I mean, they could have stayed around Bethlehem because they had family there too. But it says he was afraid. And you wonder, well, where's the rest of that story? Well, it's not in the Bible, but if you go to other sources, historical sources, they tell stories about what this Archelaus was like. He made his dad look like a Boy Scout. I mean, he killed thousands at a time. When the Jews would be there to worship, he'd send in soldiers, and they'd just slaughter these Jews at Passover, whenever they gathered together. And he was responsible for literally tens of thousands of deaths. And so when the word comes back to Joseph, Herod's dead. Oh, that's good. Archelaus is now in charge. Ooh, you know, and so now the stories have circulated about Archelaus. Terrible, terrible people. So Joseph says, I'm not sticking around any place where he's involved, so he heads up north. But that's kind of interesting. So you get the Bible and some other historical source that kind of click together and form something. Apparently there are also Old Testament sources that do this as well, that you can go to like a book of Samuel and go someplace else, and the two will end up telling a whole story. And so I'm not going to take the time doing that. But as far as just conclusion goes, the main thing I want you to get out of this is not to worry about all these particular verses and all. But the key thing is that this is what eyewitnesses do. And does it really prove that these were eyewitnesses? No, but it strikes me as pretty powerful. And it's just one more brick in a wall that you can build of apologetics to convince other people that there's truth to this, that these people were writers who were there, who saw that sort of stuff, and who put these things together, and then you get the complete story as a result, and you end up with trustworthy documents. So I just think it's a really interesting thing. If you just type in that word, undesigned coincidences, you'll see it.